Okay, thank you for having me here. So what I will be talking about is based on the paper which is on the archive, and the work was done together with Fyodor Bezrukov and Dmitry Levkov. Here's the plan. So first I will give some general ideas about how to construct semi-classicalized matrices. Then what we want to do with the application to gravity and black hole, and what we actually could do. So first some generalities. So how we...
We mean in the sentence. What we is...
We, I mean, me and my co-authors.
Not us as a collective community.
Oh, no. okay. So S-matrix. So just very schematically, we can write, any transition amplitude, between initial and final states, is given by Feynman path integral, So it's an integral over, So here I have integration over initial final coordinates. So phi is collective coordinate of the system. I insert the wave functions of initial, of final and initial states. And there is the integral between between the initial and final moments over all trajectories which connect the corresponding configuration. Here I put the action of the system. With boundary conditions, phi initial, phi final. Okay, and here also I integrate from initial to final time. So this is like the standard expression, very formal, very ill-defined in general. But there are two regimes where this can be computed. So one is when we are doing perturbation theory. So when we have a few particles in the initial and final states, and the interactions are weak, and then we can expand this perturbatively in perturbation theories. So this is one regime. So this calculation is actually known to break down for gravity in the regime of strong interaction when we expect to start producing black holes. Well, there is another regime which is also assessed when this expression can be made meaningful. It's the semiclassical regime. So what semiclassical regime means? An interaction must be still weak in some sense. So weak interactions. On the other hand, the number of particles can be large, and actually it is better when it is large. So large number of particles. Or better to put it more precisely, large occupation numbers. Occupation numbers. In the initial and final states. Let me see if I didn't miss anything. And then under these conditions, the integral can be computed using the saddle point approximation. So let me be more specific. What do I mean by large occupation numbers? What particular initial and final states I will be interested in? So these are the states I will be interested in are coherent states. So they are produced by acting with an exponential on the vacuum, So here, I use the first condition, that the interactions are weak. So in the initial and final states, the system linearizes and is described by collection of free particles.
When you say large occupation, would you want that to be true for the initial and final states, or what?
Better for both. I will say a bit more about that. But okay, let's assume that it's true. For both initial and final states, I take them to be described by coherent states with large occupation numbers.
So a collision of two high energy particles would not be something that...
Not immediately. but I will comment on that later. Okay, so this I will call a coherent state alpha. So it's described, its parameter is defined by this expansion coefficients alpha n. And large number of particles means that the sum of alpha n squared is much bigger than 1. Well, where n is some generalized index for the wave packet, for example. So this is the total number of particles. which must be large. Ideally, I would also would like to have like individual occupation numbers to be large, but that's of course impossible. So some modes will be populated, some not. But we assume that only those modes which are highly populated kind of are actively participating in the process. So then I can consider S matrix between two coherent states. I can take coherent state in the beginning, coherent state in the end, both with large occupation numbers, right, similar path integral, and in that case, take this path integral using saddle point technique.
Is all this in flat space?
Well, I'm discussing some very general situation now. Yes, I assume having.
What's an occupation number?
Yeah, I assume having asymptotically flat space. Yeah, asymptotically flat. Not necessarily flat in the middle. Okay. Yeah, but asymptotically flat, yeah. Okay, so I have this integral. This can be taken using saddle point, and the outcome is that this is, okay, it's proportional. Or, okay, let me put equal to some prefactor, which I, well, in principle is calculable, but I won't be able to calculate it. So this, this will leave, for the moment, I don't pretend that I know how to calculate it. But then there is a leading semiclassical exponent, which is the action calculated, evaluated at the classical solution. Plus, there are some boundary terms coming from the initial final wave functions. Okay, so here I can put the initial, which depends on phi classical and alpha, and the final, which depends on phi classical, so on the solution, and beta. Beta star, actually. Now, what is this phi classical? So phi classical, as I said already, it's solution of the equations of motion, of classical equations of motion, but not necessarily real. Yeah, even if I start from a, say, real scalar field here, this solution is in general allowed to be complex. Why? Because, well, besides being solution of the equations of motion, it must satisfy the boundary conditions, which are set by the initial and final state. And these boundary conditions, they are formulated in terms of the asymptotics of this solution. So the classical solution at t going to minus infinity, as I said, I assume that the field linearizes. So this takes the form of phi minus n un, where un are some modes. Okay, can be in the case of scattering of wave packets. So these are wave packet. Wave functions, wave packets. Phi n plus u n star t. Okay, so I have this linearization in the initial state. Okay, let me put also index I here. And the boundary condition coming from having a particular coherent state in the beginning is that phi n I minus should be equal to alpha n. So basically that. So the positive frequency component of, I'm always confused which is positive frequency, which is negative frequency. Okay, let me call this, which is defined by minus, let me call it positive frequency for more confusion. So this positive frequency component must be just identical to the occupation numbers in the coherent state. And nothing is said about negative frequency component.
The original sum was over real fields?
Here, yes. The original sum was over real field, yes.
So this is like steepest descent.
Yes, yes. Okay, so the other component, the other half of boundary conditions come from the final state. So I can also make the same decomposition, well, basically the same decomposition at t going to plus infinity. I get also positive negative frequencies. And the condition of having given final state translates into having, having appropriately fixed negative frequency component in the final state. So you see, it's a problem where half of boundary conditions are given in the beginning and half are given in the end. So it's boundary value problem, and Okay, these are complex numbers. So alpha and beta are complex numbers. And as I said, say in the beginning, I cannot insist that this part is complex conjugate to this, because otherwise I won't be able to solve the problem. So that means that in general, these coefficients are not complex conjugate to these ones, and the solution is complex. Okay. What should I say else about that? So these techniques, it has been used in field theory, and also just to check that it works in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, it could be just directly compared to solution of the Schrödinger equation, and it works.
So if you just took a single harmonic oscillator and alpha and beta were just random coherent states, this classical solution would generally be complex.
Well, if you consider a kind of S matrix,
you have to put in some
perturbation. It will be. Yeah, what same toy model which was studied was an oscillator whose frequency depends on another coordinate. So it's a two-dimensional quantum mechanics with an oscillator in one dimension and with some potential bearer in another dimension. So basically, the properties of this will depend on the position in the other dimension. Yeah, and then the solution is in general complex if you fix occupation number in the beginning and at the end.
Occupation number?
Occupation numbers of the oscillator.
Fix in the sense of coherent state.
Yeah, can do in the sense of coherent state, yeah. Well, in principle, you can also fix the occupation numbers. It will be a bit different, a bit different expression, but similar. I mean, the way it's obtained is similar. I have to make a disclaimer that because the solution is complex, it does not really describe any real evolution. So you should not think about the solution as describing any real process. It's similar to the instanton. Instanton doesn't describe any real process. Yeah. It may be still that initial and final asymptotics of this solution make some sense because they are somehow related to the initial final state. So looking at them, you may get some intuition what it describes, but that's not guaranteed.
Are you assuming there's a unique solution with this problem?
Oh, that's a good question. I will come to that.
I guess if you're going after the usual semi-classical approximation, wouldn't you? Be looking for a solution which corresponded to just the usual real solution?
No, the real solution will give only some particular matrix elements where I have initial and final states which are related by real evolution. Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
But if I want a different final state, I will get a different solution, which is not.
It just so happens that the saddle is complex for this integral over real variables. Is it like ordinary integral?
Maybe. Maybe, well, there are some subtleties here. So one subtlety, for example, is about the choice of the time contour, where this solution lives. Yeah, so the solution depends on time, where this time lives. So originally, the original integral ran, of course, ran over field configurations defined along real time. Yeah, that was the original expression. But then this complex solution is not guaranteed to live along real time. Well, sometime it can, but not necessarily. So it can live somewhere along the contour, which goes into complex time, goes around certain cuts of classical solutions and come back, and there is nothing wrong with that. If the solution had this structure, so again, what this problem is precisely this.
So long as you don't run into funny phenomena like Stokes phenomena.
Yeah. So that's probably time to come to this. So now, true, I have this boundary value problem, but the space of solution can be huge because I'm actually running completely a full with all these complex configurations. So how to find the relevant ones? So to find the relevant ones, there is a procedure which is at the level of conjecture. That we should start from the solutions which we understand well, like, for example, those which are completely classical and describe certain process, okay, certain matrix element. And then I can the form, say, final initial final conditions or initial conditions or any parameter of those to the form in continuous steps. And with this deformation, I will get certain class of now complex solutions. And I assume that they still make sense. So basically, that's how I will pick up the relevant solutions, by doing small deformations. I think it, probably it amounts to the assumption that there is no Stokes phenomenon during this procedure.
Sorry, can I ask re-ask Ted's question? So if you would do this for really just an oscillator with no extra fancy stuff, then this procedure would break down, or it would work, but things would not be complex, or what?
No, but what do we want? A single oscillator with some time-dependent interaction, or what?
No.
And you need some perturbation on top of.
Or what?
Hmm?
What if you don't have that?
If I don't have that, and I find and I start from a, well, actually, I will get. Let me see.
That some of these amplitudes will be zero, or
well, these amplitudes actually won't be zero because, well, in the coherent state representation, they won't be zero because the coherent states are not orthogonal. Actually, I will need this formula, so let me put it here. So the overlap of two coherent states is non-zero. It's this. Okay, it depends on the normalizations, but with the normalization I'm using, it's sum of over n dn star alpha n. So in fact, I will find that. So I will find a certain trajectory. Yeah, in the coherent state representation, I will actually find some trajectory, which will give me this.
So there will be a complex trajectory.
Yeah, there will be a complex trajectory, yeah.
Okay. Is this because these states are not normalized to 1? If you normalize them to 1, you'd get something which meant it beta n minus alpha n squared.
Yeah.
Sorry?
That's because these states are not
normalized. Okay. I can normalize, if I normalize beta and alpha to 1, so like that, they are not normalized. If I normalize, then I have here an addition of bn squared minus alpha n squared.
Right. So the square of the inner product is the e to the minus, the difference squared. E to the minus alpha n minus beta n squared.
But I prefer to keep it holomorphic. So I don't want to put that right away. For these analytic continuations, it's more convenient to keep everything holomorphic and then include this normalization at the end. Okay, so that was the first part. So more questions about that? Yeah.
So how about pair production in an electric field? So the phi is the electric field?
Yes.
And then could you say what the boundary
is? I know the instant on the string representation, yeah?
Yeah, that's with particles.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm, but you want for the fields?
Yeah.
Let me think.
Well, if it's
I think it's given by it, yeah.
It's a big issue. I just thought it's a simple problem, and I thought there might be some. Simple answer, but if there's not, let's not hold you back.
Yeah, it's a different problem, definitely, but I think I can formulate the same boundary conditions, and then we can look at what will be the solution. So, definitely will be related to the Schwinger circle,
but the Schwinger circle involves changing variables, but you deal with particle, particle trajectory.
Yeah, yeah, but this
it's
is like...
That's well known, but you're saying...
Yeah, I would expect this a geometric approximation to some field theoretic. Solution. Okay, but yeah. Okay, more questions? Okay, then to the second part. So maybe I should not erase that. So now we want to apply it to the gravitational system. So that was very general formalism. And actually, as I said, it was applied to various problems in the field theory, like baryon number violating processes and. Scattering with large spinal multiplicities. Another thing, which probably is worth commenting here, about the validity of semiclassical approximation. So as I said, ideally we would like to have occupation numbers large in the beginning and the end, and a quantity which roughly characterizes the semiclassics is basically the value of this action that we obtain. Yeah, so this action must be big. Must be much bigger than 1. It need not necessarily be imaginary. Yeah. So okay. In many cases, these processes are exponentially suppressed. So because this S has imaginary part. But this is not required. So it's not necessary that this process must be exponentially suppressed. Generically, it will. But even if I have a real action which is large, it's still a valid semiclassical approximation. Well, actually, we can go a bit. So preserving that, we can go somewhat beyond this approximation. So it was. So for example, in the case of collision of particles, yeah. So I can start from collision of wave packets with those occupation numbers, but then I can consider a limit that n, say, initial number of particles going to zero, for example, keeping the energy fixed. And the initial energy fixed. And then if this effective action has a well-defined value in this limit, I can actually consider, and actually in many cases it turns out to have this well-defined limit. So I can take this value as the leading semiclassical exponent describing a process from a few particles into many. I'm not going to do that in the gravitational case, but in principle that's possible to take these limits and see what happens. Okay, so now I go to the gravitational case. There is this expression for the matrix element. So basically I want to take it as it is at face value and apply it to gravity. The initial final states, okay, yeah, let me specify more the system which I want to consider.
So the metric is part of phi?
Yes. Now I'm specifying the system. So ideally, what we would like to do? We would like to take scalar field coupled to gravity. So the total action would be an action of scalar plus action for gravity. It's feasible to solve this, this classical equation, to find these configurations. In many cases, it must be done numerically, and it's feasible to do it only in spherically reduced situations. Though, it's a technical requirement. It's not a requirement of principle. It doesn't seem to be a requirement of principle. But technically, okay. So we would consider a scalar field plus gravity reduced to spherically symmetric configurations.
This is like a mini superspace of conformation.
Okay. Look, I'm not making this reduction at the quantum level. So the quantum theory is full and is four-dimensional. I'm just considering initial and final states, which are spherically symmetric. Assume that the solution will be also spherically symmetric. It's only at the level of semiclassics that I do this reduction. So this is this system we want to study. Let me see what I have to say here. So then the process we want to study. So we want to take a spherically symmetric wave packet. It's okay with some blurring, some wave packet with some limits, with some widths. Basically collapsing or contracting, and want to see the transition of from this state into similar wave packet. Which expands. Both wave packets will be made of soft modes with omega, with frequencies much smaller than Planckian mass, but with total energy much bigger than the Planck mass. So the total energy, number of particles times omega, much bigger than the Planck mass.
So this is very far from what you would expect for the classical evolution from this initial state.
Yes.
And so this is going to be some exponentially suppressed contribution, basically?
In most cases, yes.
S matrix.
Yeah. Okay, I will also come to that. Yeah.
Are you going to try to look at the dominant configurations at all in the story, or?
Yeah, to try to see which will be dominant. Okay, maybe I will comment later. Let's keep this. So for the moment, yeah, just two semi-classical configurations. In general, I expect it to be exponentially suppressed, true. Well, also depends on the regime. So look, so first I can start from the regime where basically this wave packet classically scatters, scatter classically, does not produce a black hole. There is this regime, yeah? So I fix the shape of the wave packet, put a small energy, I mean relatively small, so that the wave packet scatters.
Does the wave packet include the metric?
Yeah, the metric in the sense, well, here in the spherical reduced case, it's just given by constraints. But so asymptotically, the metric.
So asymptotically, it's
asymptotically doesn't contribute. It's just flat.
So there's no coherent state for gravitons.
No, no, right. No.
No.
Yeah, because gravitons would violate spherical symmetry.
Right.
So here.
You wouldn't have the spherical
symmetry. Yeah, but then in the evolution, in the intermediate evolution, the gravity is taken fully into account, nonlinearly. Yeah, so I start from small energies where this happens kind of classically. I pick up the classical solution, which describes the scattering, and then I start changing the parameters of the final state, say if I want to scan over different coherent states in the end, coherent final states, and I also increase the energy so that I go over the threshold when I expect classically to produce a black hole. And I expect that the amplitude which I get, I can interpret as basically the scattering through a black hole, because classically I expect a black hole, so.
But are you still only keeping one classical solution when you approach that threshold?
I'm keeping one classical solution, which is determined by boundary conditions, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so here. Yeah, maybe I should start from disclaimers. It was already.
Just understand. There's only a single classical solution because you've assumed these fairly symmetric boundary conditions. In general, you would have some complex solutions to nonlinear equations in motion. You might have many solutions to this problem.
Well, there should be a discrete set because the number of boundary conditions match to the number of equations. So I have second order equations of motion and I have, the appropriate number.
You're modified to be complex.
Hmm? Yeah, but I have. Two complex boundary conditions. These are complex equations. The number match. The number of boundary conditions match to the solutions.
Is there a nonlinear interaction for the scalar field?
It's through gravity. So some comments. In general, I expect to get only. If I now invoke the intuition we have about black holes, so black hole decay is dominated by Hawking radiation, which is of course not semi-classical because the occupation numbers are small. So in this way, I probably won't get the domain contribution into the S matrix, but only some exponentially suppressed tails. Still, I can ask certain questions about them. At least this will be some handle. It's like a tail, you know, the complete S matrix, and I can ask various questions. One question is. For example, in which sense these S-matrix elements are thermal? Yeah, in which sense? The intermediate state is thermal. Second, how the matrix elements depend on the changes in initial and final states. Third, what is the relevance of singularity? Is singularity relevant for this or not? Or I can avoid? Because why can I avoid singularity? Because the solution becomes complex, and in principle, I can go away from the singular point. Finally, I can even dream about checking the unitarity of the S-matrix in the following way. So I can construct an object like that, like S dagger S A. So from one coherent state, scatter into some intermediate state, then scatter back, and sum over all intermediate states. So
But if you're not getting the dominant configuration in the middle, then you might worry that you're not going to satisfy the unitary.
Yeah, look, what can happen, and most probably will happen, that when I formulate the semi-classical equation, semi-classical problem for this object, I get that it is, so it will be actually some solution which goes forward in time and then backward in time, something like that. And most probably, it won't just have any semi-classical solutions. So the solutions satisfying the corresponding boundary conditions and equations will be singular in some sense. But then I can play and try to smear, to introduce some constraints. Actually, I will talk about one of possible constraints in a minute. Well, not for this problem, but for a different obstacle. Okay, so introduce some constraints so that here in the middle I integrate only over semi-classical configuration. And then, yeah, because you know, I mean, after all, the coherent state basis is complete. So dc, dc, okay. C, okay, with some weight, I mean, it's equal to 1. So that I will find, it will be exponentially suppressed, true. And then I will start removing this regulator. And I can see what happened. So one case, like the optimal case, is that when I remove the regulator, this actually goes with exponential accuracy, of course, because I cannot do better. But it goes to this expression, bn, an. That will be the best possible outcome. So I see that the limit of what I get here goes to that. And then this is a test of unitarity. Or it can have no limit in this case. Basically, when I remove the regulator, this object doesn't have any limit, or it has their own limit. Okay, at that point, I should sit down and think what it means. Does it mean that the S matrix doesn't exist, or it means that's the breakdown of the method? But I agree that this part of checking unitarity is kind of speculative. But rather, the other, you know, other questions which I mentioned, I better post. Okay.
You don't expect it to be exactly unitary at the level of this analysis.
No, exactly. Of course, I can never get because I omitted the prefactor, for example. No, what I can do, I can only check the leading like exponential behavior and try to understand what it means, try to interpret it. Okay, so that was part two. More questions? Yes.
There's a conflict between checking unitarity and the previous approximation you discussed, which was exclusive processes.
Yes.
Which were exponentially suppressed.
Yeah.
In unitarity, you have all processes.
Yeah.
All final states.
Yes.
Many of which don't agree with your assumption. So how could you possibly?
Yeah, I'm thinking here about summing over intermediate coherent states with this formula.
There's a complete basis, but you could have coherent states, presumably exclusive probabilities that aren't exponentially suppressed, they presumably contribute.
The fact that they contribute, I will see, I must see, in this solution, in the saddle point solution, becoming singular. Because those configurations which are dominant, they are not semi-classical. But it may happen that the leading semi-classical exponent has a well-defined limit in this case. Like it happened with this in the problem of like two-particle scattering, non-perturbative processes induced by two-particle scattering. There it happens that the leading semi-classical exponent has a well-defined limit when you send the number of particles to zero, even. I mean, though the solution becomes singular. I must say that here, and about this check of unitarity, I don't insist that it will be I will get yes or no from it. I rather, my take on that is that here I can try to see what happens. What happens and then try to interpret it.
But if everything is exponentially suppressed and B equals A, you should get 1. And how are you going to get that from?
Just the exponential suppression goes to 0 in the limit. S goes to 0. So the exponential suppression disappears, for example.
For what channel?
Okay, that's where now this, again, about what happens in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying using completeness.
Yeah.
For which?
Yeah, I think for the channel, okay, again, my guess is that for the channel when C's become small, so in every particular mode, I get less and less particles. So I will see the saturation of my whatever expression in the limit where all the equation numbers become smaller and smaller. Okay, we can discuss it. That's an interesting question. okay, so now what we were able to do so far. Okay, we wanted to simplify the problem as much as possible, to have some analytic handle on it. Because of course, I mean, well, though we reduced everything to solution of partial differential equations, but it's nonlinear system, so it can be done only numerically. And before doing any numerics, it's better to understand what we are doing. Yeah, I mean, to what we expect to have as an answer. So the ultimate simplification which you considered is when both initial and final wave packets are narrow, in some sense. Okay. Narrow wave packets, yeah? Then let us model them by thin shells. And thin shells, okay, for thin shells, we already can do some analytic calculations. So basically, the model we considered was so the action, yeah, is given by a thin shell with mass m, some mass m, plus Einstein-Hilbert action, plus Gibbons-Hawking term. Yeah, actually, I must also say here that for gravity, I just use Einstein-Hilbert action because, again, of this idea that in this regime where kind of wave packets are spread, when the frequencies are much more than Planckian, this intermediate solution should be also smooth and should be described just by standard GR. Okay, so here I take GR. Okay, so take this thin shells. Now, thin shells, okay, they are easy to solve, but they don't have this property, which I mentioned, that I want to continue from real scattering to some classically forbidden scattering. Because thin shells, they always collapse and form a black hole. That's their, you know, that's what they do. So here we need to make a trick and basically assume that, formally the trick is just to substitute this mass m here by some m effective, which is m square plus l square over r square, where r is the radius of the shell. Now, where this expression comes from? So this comes from the idea to introduce a centrifugal barrier for the shells. So these thin shells can be thought as a collection of dust particles, yeah, I mean, the same. So what I can do, I can generalize a bit the action by assuming that these particles, which are uniformly distributed on the shell, they also have velocities in all directions randomly. So that the classical dynamics of the system is always spherical, but they do have some non-zero angular momentum. So basically, this L is the total angular momentum of all the particles. You can view it in both ways, either as this physical model, or just as mathematical regularization, which allows to have configurations which scatter.
The action you've written down is the action for one particle, but there's another dimension to the shell. So you think of the
No, this is already the action for the whole shell. So M is I already integrated over the sphere here.
Integrated out the spherical direction.
Yeah, integrated out the spherical direction here. Okay.
Well, you're treating it as effectively one. Well, it's like one particle.
Yeah, because I'm in reduced situation of one plus one.
If the particles have transverse velocities like that, isn't that inconsistent with the shell remaining a shell?
No, because they have velocities along the shell direction.
Right.
So and they're isotropically distributed velocity.
Where does the L? Is that spinning around?
Yeah. So every particle is spinning around the center, but then I have many particles which are smeared around the shell and also have velocities in all possible directions.
I see that you can set up an initial condition like that, but as the shell is coming in, why would?
Oh, this is preserved by devolution. Okay, that's preserved by devolution.
The total angular momentum is zero, but
the total angular momentum is zero. Yeah.
Squares.
Yeah, so let's put it this way. Li vector is zero, but the sum of absolute values of Li is L.
These particles all see the same radial potential.
Yeah.
Because they all have the same value of L.
Yeah.
So they move together.
So then what we get? What kind of dynamics we get? So basically, after I write down the equations of motion for this system and there is only a single dynamical degree of freedom, which is the radius of the shell, depending on time. So there's a single variable. And for this variable, basically this variable evolves in an effective potential. It's like a motion of a particle with zero mass in an effective potential. And the effective potential, it depends, okay, let me put here, it depends on the total energy of the shell of the system, which is the mass, like I call it M, and L, okay. Okay, I should put those here, and L, so it depends on both variables. There is, of course, an analytic expression for it, but it's not instructive. What is better is the plot, and the plot goes like that. So for L bigger than certain critical value, which depends on the mass, goes like that. Okay, I have a potential bearer. So basically the shell comes and reflects back. Then what I do, I lower L by, you know, continuously. And this potential goes, of course, you know, goes down. And at some point, classically, I have just transmission through. But I want to insist on considering the process when I have a shell in the beginning and the shell at the end. I don't want the shell to fall into the singularity. So in this language, it's just an overbearer reflection. An overbearer reflection from this, like in quantum mechanics. I have to take basically the same trajectories which I would take in quantum mechanics if I want to consider the overbearer reflection. Now for overbearer reflections. Basically, how I find these trajectories. So the trajectories are, let me draw here, the complex R plane. Yeah, the trajectories for overbearer reflection, they are found, okay, from this equation which I have here. So they will, They will be given by implicitly by that. Yeah, minus dr over 2 df r, something like that. Right? Minus sign. The question is, what is this contour of this integration contour? And the integration contour for reflected trajectories, for classical reflected trajectories. Okay, it runs to the nearby turning point and comes back. So let me call this turning point A, and there is another turning point A prime on the real axis. So when I decrease L, the two turning points move together, towards each other, collide, and then go to the complex plane. So one goes here, another comes here. Now, for overbearer reflection, I have to pick up the turning point which goes down. We know this prescription from standard quantum mechanics, but actually we can also derive this prescription, which, I probably don't have time to talk about that, but there is another regulator which can be included in the whole game to go. This is the example of the situation when I really don't know how to go from real trajectories to complex trajectories because of this bifurcation of the turning points. But I can resolve this bifurcation by introducing another regulator. But yeah, maybe I won't speak about that. We can deform the system in such a way that basically these turning points, they continuously go into one another. It's interesting what happens with this turning point afterwards. So the whole calculation looks very much like overbearer reflection. So basically there is some turning point in the complex plane. We have this potential here, which is below our energy, but we have some reflection from it. But when L, when the angular momentum goes to zero, the potential bearer completely disappears, and the turning point travels, you know, somewhere in the complex plane and comes to r equals zero. So it comes to the vicinity of the singularity. Basically, the distance from the singularity is controlled by L. Now, how in this case my contour looks now, yeah? So now the contour looks like that the shell travels and on the real axis. Here there is horizon somewhere, so it must go below the horizon, travels almost to the singularity, make a small excursion in the complex plane and comes back. And then make this excursion, goes around the turning point and comes back. So physically the process looks like that I have a shell which collapses. Well, basically the initial part of the whole evolution is that the shell just goes under the horizon. Good, that's what I expect. And then at some point it comes out from like a white hole probably. Okay, so let me draw it better. So the Penrose diagram looks like that. If I try to embed the shell in the Penrose diagram of the outer metric. So there is a shell which goes here. Here it makes a small excursion into complex plane and comes to the real coordinates and actually propagates backward in time. But then to close the contour of the time contour, I have to go back because this part of the contour is not on the real time axis. If you remember, I draw this picture of the general time contour, which would have this form. It was like that, comes back, and must come back. So basically, this part of the evolution is somewhere here, roughly speaking. So I have to bring the shell back to the real time, and that is done by analytical continuum from here to here. So and then I have here the shell which propagates outwards. Okay, so I describe this process from colliding shell into expanding shell. With this kind of embedding.
Sorry, what does it mean to analog continuum along that form?
Say it again, please.
I didn't understand what you meant when you said you analog. You have a solution which is doing something in the in this complexified plane. And
yes.
You analytically continue.
Yeah, this is analytic. Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, here the solution, the coordinate of the shell is complex, so I don't know what it means. And complex, some complex.
Do you have some explicit prescription, or
yes.
What exactly do you do?
Yeah, completely explicit prescription in the sense that I have a solution x of t, or t of x, okay, either way, r of t, I mean, which I have to consider from initial time to final time, which are both on the real axis. And this r can be complex, and t can be complex. So then I know the contour in time, which I shall go around to get. Actually, I get this contour automatically. No, it's not that I impose it by hand, but from this procedure, I get the corresponding contour and the solution. The problem is that here. Well, to be honest, here R is it has an imaginary part. So it has a real part, which is basically at large times. Okay, let me put here. So R is approximately T. Yeah, okay. The shell just expands with the unit velocity, but there is some imaginary part here. So this imaginary part is generated when I go from here to here. But the solution stays of this form everywhere.
But your boundary condition should be that R is real at TF, right?
No.
Well,
no.
That's the way you've drawn it.
But that's along this part of the contour. So. Okay, so let me point like that.
But you've drawn it in the complex R plane.
Now here, R is almost real, but this is along this part of the contour. So I end up, so this asymptotics corresponds to real R but complex time. You see, I can trade complex time and complex R between each other.
And one of the things, maybe the confusion is that the two different sides of the black hole have different values of the complex time coordinate.
Here I'm working everywhere just in Schwarzschild coordinates because I'm doing this analytic continuations.
Different value. I mean, if the Schwarzschild coordinate is real on one side, it has an imaginary time variable has an imaginary part on the other. Right? So if you move back to the original,
Totally right.
So if you move back to the original side, then if you move according to the equations of, are you evolving back to the original side according to the equations of motion?
Yeah. This is 4 pi I m. Yeah, so this is exactly. Because when I do these analytic continuations from this part to here, I get an imaginary part in time. That, along this contour, actually, if I compute time using this formula, along this contour, I get imaginary contribution into time. So if I want to bring the whole system back to the real time, that's basically this part.
This is, the board is like the real sheet, and he's coming up out of the board and going back.
But I guess when you move from one side to the other, it seems like you're going one way according to the equations of motion, and then are you going back according to the equations of motion or not?
Yeah, but here equations of motion are just trivial. The solution is free. So this is the free part.
When you move an imaginary time, the value of R doesn't change?
No, because here I have this expression. So free meaning that R is proportional to time. So if there is any imaginary part of time generated, okay, so here R is real, yeah? At this point. So at this point, it will have this 4 pi im. Whatever.
Yeah, so what's the part look like going down the step?
That's the...
I think that's what's being asked.
What's this
what
part?
What does the solution look like that goes down from the down the step? No, that's the part
going down.
This is analytic solution, analytic expression for R in terms of time. It's valid everywhere here.
Okay.
what I shall say. Okay, now what is the matrix element? The matrix element, I just take this action and compute it. I take this trajectory, I take the expression for the action and compute the matrix element. And what I find, so. First about the imaginary part, which is probably interesting to look at. It's non-zero, and it's equal exactly to 2 pi m squared, which is the entropy of the black hole over 2. This contribution comes purely from the horizon, so that's interesting. That the contribution comes purely from the horizon, because here when I go around, though R is real, in the action there is a pole contribution. There is a pole in the expression for the action. So when I go past the horizon and backward, I get some contribution into this action. While this part which comes from kind of vicinity of the singularity, I also have for non-zero L, I have a small contribution from here, but it vanishes when L is sent to zero. So in this sense, a singularity seems to be irrelevant to this expression. then physical interpretation. So this is very, something natural to expect, that basically I have so the picture is like that I have a wave packet which collapses and forms a black hole, and then this black hole decays in a featureless wave packet. And of course, this decay is suppressed by the entropy of black holes, because it decays at a single state.
So if you did the sort of Parekh-Wilczek approach to black hole evaporation by tunneling?
Yes.
That's just the same as this. That's just basically the same as the second half of this calculation.
Yes, that's the same answer. There are some things I didn't understand in the Hawking radiation and tunneling picture, where basically I never could understand where the shell they consider comes from, because they consider like a quantum mechanical situation when you have a particle which goes to the potential barrier, okay, and then they find the transmission coefficient. But where this particle comes from? So here, this particle or the shell, it actually is there from the beginning. It's the shell which we consider. Another feature here is that the expression for the action is the original expression is a completely coordinate invariant. So in the Schwarzschild coordinates, the contribution into imaginary part of the action comes both from crossing the horizon inside and outside. Looks a bit weird. I mean, why shall I get any contribution from crossing inside? But the answer is that separately, these two contributions doesn't make sense. You have to consider the whole integral. And if I go, say, to Pandeleri coordinates, I don't get any contributions from coming in, but I get it twice more from coming out.
So is the over 2 because the process is the amplitude squared?
Yes, over 2 is that because of that. another thing which we can get compared to the, in addition to what this Hawking radiation is tunneling picture, and that we get the real part of the action, which describes the phase shift. And say for a massless shell in the limit when L goes to zero, it also has a well-defined limit. And it's given by this. It's given by, okay, so here there is some problem because we considered four dimensions, and there are some logarithmic divergence associated to long-range interactions in the initial final state. So we had to regulate them. So because of that, we have to introduce some you know, coordinate which normalize the phase, where basically the phase of the wave function vanishes, and there is a logarithmic contribution proportional to that. But then there is the final part, m square. So basically, the phase shift is given by the same, well, it's of the same order as the imaginary part. Okay, but we know the coefficient. So coefficient is just one. yeah, and also this phase shift depends. So what R0 here is just the distance from the center where I start my wave packet, kind of. So it's this first part is just geometrical contribution coming from the wave packet propagating towards the center and then backward. If there were no logarithm here, I could just send this R0 to zero to normalize my wave packets properly. But I cannot do it because of this log. But this is the meaningful phase shift. Yeah, what else? yeah.
This log looks like it has to do with the amount of time to the amount of Schwarzschild time that it takes to fall
yeah,
to the horizon.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. So in higher dimensions must be absent, so maybe it's worth repeating quickly. Yeah, well, in higher dimensions.
Different factor.
Hmm?
I think it's just a different term. It's not absent.
You think there will be some contribution?
Well, into,
because here, in our case, it really came from some log divergence of the total action associated clearly with Newtonian interaction at the final
maybe
level.
Maybe it's subleading.
Can you read off the time delay from the phase? So the time.
The time delay is m here, I would say. Yeah.
Why doesn't the log term contribute?
Okay, plus log. But log is something which is related to the shift of the phase because of Newtonian interaction in the outskirts. So.
This log is like the logarithmic Shapiro time delay at long distances.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so for Schwarzschild black hole, after all, getting here m square, okay, so it's nice, we get this result, Okay, but let's look here. So, could be a coincidence, because m square you just get by dimensional basis, there is nothing else, and the coefficient, okay, could be 2 pi just comes accidentally, because everything is made out of residues, okay, no wonder you can get 2 pi. So basically, it's bad. We want to check it at something which has more parameters in the game. Okay, and we checked this. So we checked it for AGS, for the case of black hole in AGS, and again get the same result, this result, that the imaginary part is just equal to entropy over 2, which comes out rather non-trivially there, because the expression for the action is something quite complicated. The pole contributions are also quite complicated, but then there are cancellations and everything combines into the Schwarzschild radius. And also we did it for charged black holes, where the situation is more tricky. Okay, do I have how much time do I have?
What do you need at this point?
Well, maybe 10 minutes. Okay, 5. I can.
Okay. Speak quickly.
Yeah, I just have time. Need time to draw something. So for a black hole, for a charged black hole, if I just take a charged shell and nothing else, I get Reisner-Knudsen metric, and then say the solution which I get in that case. Yeah, so here I'm drawing Reisner-Knudsen. The solution I get in that case is that the shell goes in, goes through outer horizon and through inner horizon, reflects, because the charge reflects from the charge singularity, repels basically from it, and comes back, yeah, comes into the other asymptotic region. Okay, so that's the solution I get, and the expression for the imaginary part of the action, twice, is, for this solution, is r plus, where it's positive horizon, minus r minus squared. So it's like the difference of the two areas.
So the incoming, the outgoing state is in a completely different
That's probably not a problem because from here I have to make analytic continuation backward.
You have to go back.
Yeah, so maybe that's okay.
So I don't understand. There's a. Is this solution complex as well? I
mean, yes.
Is it? I understand it's complex and it's worth.
That time is complex.
But yeah. There is a completely real solution in Kruskal coordinates.
Yes.
Exactly this.
Yes.
Is this the same solution written in? Complex Schwarzschild?
But when you map it into Schwarzschild coordinates from Kruskal, you get imaginary contribution coming from the time. Because actually this expression for effective action, it contains also, you know, contribution associated with boundary, these boundary terms. And the boundary term, they contain in particular, like in quantum mechanics, they would contain this term. Energy times time, difference of times, initial and final times. And when I do this analytic continuation from here to here, I get imaginary part here and here. And
this is where I'm worried by this phrase, to do an analytic continuation. I mean, there's a solution which is just this in real Kruskal coordinates. And in that form, its action is manifestly real.
Yeah.
And so I'm confused. One thing you could be doing is just rewriting that in complex Schwarzschild coordinates.
Yes.
Which couldn't change the action, because the action is invariant even under complex coordinate transformations.
Yeah, but I have to define carefully the action. So it's not just the action from here to here, but it's action plus some boundary terms. And the boundary terms can also become complex.
Why?
Maybe I should not concentrate on that, because I'm going to argue that this solution is unphysical.
Okay.
First of all, yeah. So it's unphysical because it's unphysical in field theory. Okay. Maybe for a single charge shell, that's probably the answer. But okay, we don't believe in existence of single charge shells and their meaningfulness. So for a field theory, we know that this inner horizon will actually be destroyed by mass inflation singularity, or better to say, by discharge of the singularity. So basically, the singularity will discharge and become, so this whole Penrose diagram will go just to a simple Schwarzschild diagram. The causal structure will be the same as the Schwarzschild black hole.
I don't think that's quite accurate for mass inflation. It's probably close enough for your purposes.
Okay, maybe. Okay, we should discuss that. But okay, so assuming that it goes here, I can model discharge of the singularity in my reduced spherically symmetric model, and the discharge will be modeled just by putting the charge of the shell to depend on the radius. Yeah, and I make it like that. That the charge basically vanishes when the electromagnetic coupling constant vanishes when r goes to zero. And once I do that, I actually recover the entropic suppression. So this inner horizon disappears completely, and independently of the choice of this function, again, everything combines in such a way that I recover the entropic suppression.
You're saying that you need to take into account discharge of the singularity?
Yes.
In order to get the usual entropic.
Yes, so that's the moral. So the moral of this charged example is that the charge of the singularity is needed to recover this thermodynamic kind of thermal type behavior for the matrix element. Yeah.
It's a little surprising because I completely agree that this, as a real physical solution, there's an instability there. But I thought there was some evidence that if we're doing analytic stuff like this, the solution has some relevance. You know, for example, people computed this weird numerology about inner and outer horizons and the difference in entropies being an integer, and also some ways that appeared in the quasi-normal modes and so on. So
I wouldn't think it would be crazy to use this path in, you know, in some analog to compute some saddle point.
Well, maybe for some purpose it can be adequate, but not for this problem. So for apparently not for this problem, because this answer actually which appears, this R plus minus R minus, which appears in the pure shell model, from the point of view of this shell model, that's how it should be actually, because the suppression cannot start with a jump. Yeah, this exponential suppression should change continuously from zero. Okay, so at the moment when the classical reflection becomes impossible, so basically when these horizons appear, it should be zero. While if you just take entropic suppression, it has a jump. But well, this regulator, what it allows to do is actually allows continuous change of, well, it leads to continuous change of the horizon radius from zero, slowly and continuously increasing. And that's,
So does the interpretation make sense for the extremal case? I mean, there I might have guessed that no black hole.
For extremal, it also applies, yeah.
Formed, so it shouldn't be suppressed or something like that at all.
So you're asking if, are you asking that extremal black hole should not decay? Are you asking about that?
Or if
not?
A collapsing extremal shell should not have exponentially suppressed reflection probability.
Yeah, and that's what happens in this regularized model, kind of, which accounts for discharge, actually. So in the case, if I don't account for the discharge, the exponential suppression would behave like that. That I have, say, energy, I increase energy, and then the suppression is 0, 0, 0, and then, oh, it jumps and increases. If I take entropic suppression here, so this is the plot for this case. Mm-hmm. So this is extremal black hole, and there is some discontinuity which cannot appear, which should not appear in this kind of problems, because the suppression should change continuously. Okay, so if I take instead this expression, it indeed changes continuously, but I get something different from the standard. From what I expect entropically, yes? I don't recover the entropic formula. On the other hand, if I introduce this regularization, I get, which is not regularization, it's a model. It's a model for discharge, yeah? Then I get something like that.
Well, maybe it's right that you don't recover the entropic formula, because it's not like you're doing a process on a background that has a definite horizon size. You know, the space-time is being created by the shell as it's propagating.
Well, look, I don't...
It has an initial...
Well, I'm not trying to impose that by hand. I mean, I'm not trying to impose this entropic suppression by hand. I'm trying to see if I get it or not, yeah? Now, for me, entropic suppression looks natural because I have this interpretation that basically this is the probability of a black hole to decay into a single state, yeah? What I see that if I don't include discharge, I get this formula, which is not standard entropic suppression. Okay, you may find an interpretation for it, I don't know. But if I account for the discharge, then I recover the good old entropic suppression. So from this point of view, okay, maybe my last statement is that discharge of the black hole must be taken into account to recover entropic suppression of this kind of process, okay. Of course, the next step, okay, what we are doing now is to take some field theory where you can have softening of the quanta, and to see how if this is translates into there, to what extent this translates into there. Okay, thank you.
In your last comment, what do you mean by softening of the quanta?
Meaning that I. Yeah, in that case, I could consider, I could change basically the frequency, characteristic frequency of initial final state, and I would expect that, say, softer final states will be preferred. Still
okay.
Far.
Okay. Other questions?
I just want to make sure when you draw that diagram, that's like a trajectory on a Reisner-Nordström background.
Yeah.
But really, the shell is creating the background as it goes, right?
Ah, yeah, well, I'm patching. So here, yeah, so here I take on the outer part of
right.
It. Yeah, this, of course, I'm patching the two geometries. That's how the whole geometry is the patch of the tomb along the trajectory. And here I have to take only the outer part. Well, actually, for this diagram, I'm even confused whether I have to take this singularity or not. I don't know.
Yes, for your exact solution, as you say, that's the region which
is. Yeah, but I prefer to go to the other one, which is Schwarzschild, and there I understand much better what's happening.
But you know, I mean, if your shell is very, very close to spherical, then the region which is removed is actually just the region above this. So you keep the little.
No, it's okay, so in the Schwarzschild case, yeah, the shell goes like that. I actually keep, as far as I remember, how did it go? I think I keep something up to this.
I just mean if you're solving the problem of a real collapsing charge shell in Kruskal coordinates.
Ah, for real, for this one.
Then the correct answer with the instability.
Yeah, then I keep that. Then I have to keep that.
You don't keep with the instability. Ah, with the instability. You don't keep that, but you keep the little triangle that's to the right.
Which one?
Okay, go to the bifurcation of the surface of the air horizon is right there.
Yeah.
You keep the triangle just to the left.
This one.
No, the one to the left.
The left?
You keep it a little bit there.
This I keep, you're saying.
That part to the right of your shell, yes. You keep everything up to that.
No, but this is already unstable. I don't understand.
No, it's not.
Wow.
It's only the other one that's unstable in this configuration where you have one asymptotic region and an incoming shell.
Okay, that we must discuss. According to what I understand, that other people understand, this is unstable already. I mean, these both are unstable. No? Okay, that's
only the one with an infinite blue shell.
I think they're both, yeah, in a static black hole, they'd both be singular, but the mass inflation singularity is only on the other one, as you say. So a singularity caused by infalling stuff is only on.
Yeah,
right.
That one.
There's no asymptotic.
But the
region
field
here
is singular. I remember thinking it wasn't, and Bill Hiscock convinced me that it is singular on both pieces of the horizon.
That's how I understand.
In context, where there's only really a single asymptotic region on the collapsing shell.
I don't know about that.
If you have the two asymptotic region black hole, they're both singular and unstable. But when you have only one asymptotic region, it's just the ingoing inner horizon which is unstable.
Yeah, you can kind of see there's no infinite blue shift.
No, I also
maybe we should thank him again and move into the dirty Geo discussion.